And welcome back to Lessons of a CEO with me, Ross Hewitt. We're diving into episode 3, where we explore the intricacies of leadership in high-stress, high-stakes environments. And today, we're thrilled to welcome Kevin Dooley to the show. Kevin is not just any guest. He's a seasoned restoration contractor, large loss drying specialist with over 2 decades of experience in property restoration. And not only that, he's the CEO of Kahi, co-founder at DrySource, and also co-founder at Restoration Co. And since 2001, Kevin has shaped his career with remarkable expertise and dedication. He holds prestigious titles that include Master Water and Master Cleaner certifications from the IICRC, and has recently completed the IAWLS designation. That's a lot of acronyms.
Yeah.
And so Kevin's dedicated his career to elevating the standards of the restoration industry, and his business is primarily focused on supporting other restoration contractors by providing technical training, specialized labor resources, and disaster equipment rental services across North America and the Caribbean. So welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, buddy. That was a bit of a mouthful.
Right. Well, it's funny, man. The first time I ever heard one read back, and you're like, God, I don't feel that glamorous the way it sounds.
Yeah, for sure.
But a lot of designations and acronyms there got myself tongue tied.
It's all good.
But why don't you start off by telling us a bit about yourself, your background, and how you found your way into insurance restoration and ultimately entrepreneurship.
Sure, cool. So I live in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, for anyone that's international as well. I entered into the restoration space, frankly, as a teenager. So my dad was a restoration contractor in the 90s. And so on the weekend, sometimes in the evenings, definitely during summer, vacation away from school, I was out on the trucks hustling and working, because that's the way I was raised. Yeah. And I got from an early teenager, got my experience and my feet wet, literally, back then. And then
just to confirm, your dad owned his own restoration firm?
Yeah, so he owned his own restoration firm. He had a ServiceMaster franchise at one point that he bought in the Okanagan in BC. Mm. And he had three ServiceMaster locations, I believe. And then subsequently after that, he went independent for several years and then scaled that up to many more locations. And then, that's kind of the history. And then he got out of being a contractor, I want to say in 99. I went to go work at Dry Ease. And he worked with the founder of Dry Ease, Claude Blackburn, back in, I think it was 1999 era. And he and Claude built, they built Dry Zone, which is a flood house training center, which ultimately became what's now known as ASD, Applied Structural Drying, through the ISRC.
Right. Okay. And I have to ask you, Kevin, because with my background in insurance and certainly not being as long as yours, and having seen the call of the trials and tribulations that restoration contractors go through, or any contractor, to be frank, any business owner really, but there's just something I feel extra difficult about doing the work we do in insurance, restoring properties, attending emergencies, in normal construction. Typically, there's people excited, this project's being funded, we're building something new. And in our world, it's a little bit Undertaker-esque, isn't it? You show up and someone's had the worst day of their life.
Yeah.
And you're there to operate a business that, yes, restores it, but ultimately makes money from it, which can seem contradicting and create issues.
False.
So did you see any of that earlier on? You weren't exposed to any of that?
Well, back then, it was still kind of, kind of joke a bit of the Wild Wild West. There wasn't a whole lot of structure in terms of standard care and, the consistency on how things were done. So, it was an interesting time back then. I went through high school, obviously doing that as I shared. And then when I went into college, I took business school and, you know, least path resistance. I used restoration as my theme for a lot of my projects. And so, you know, I came out of college and had like business plans and marketing and all the stuff already kind of done. I'm like, well, I've done all this work. Might as well just keep doing it.
Yeah.
And so I ended up working with a local restoration company in Ottawa. Kind of got my feet wet a little bit more on the project management side, because that was something I hadn't really done much of, because I was just in the truck as a teenager, as I shared, and didn't have that kind of experience. And at that juncture, that this is 2002 or 2003 era, and at that point my dad had moved on, and I keep bringing him back in because it'll kind of make sense. At that point he was an independent instructor now teaching IRCRC classes, and so while I was working with that restoration company in town locally, I was helping my dad as, you know, part-time, if you will, organizing classes across country in Canada and the US. So we would book hotel conference rooms typically, and I would help him sell and organize getting students, aka contractors, into these classes. And so often I would go out and join, and I just help assist more on the hands-on type classes like the mold and some of the other hands-on classes that we would do. And what I realized back in the early 2000s is there was, to your question now, there wasn't a lot of support for restoration contractors, both in equipment and in the large loss and complex loss side of what we do. And in talking to them, I learned that there was an unserved market in there. So back then, I ended up kind of got forced upon me, actually, a little bit. And that's a story I can get into if you like. But the short version is that I ended up starting in my mom's garage. I got a few pieces from Phoenix Equipment. I started a little equipment rental service company out of my mom's garage, me and one other fella. And then over the course of claim after claim after claim, and then we actually had some really nice support from Phoenix, where they gave me some quite favorable terms on a semi truck worth of equipment.
Nice.
And we chased a hurricane that year, which was 2004.
When you say chase the hurricane, where did you chase that?
Yeah, so we went to the panhandle of Florida. I think it was 2004. Okay. And we had some contacts down there, and we dried a handful of hotels and apartment complexes.
Nice.
And did really well, and then took those proceeds and just kind of reinvested, paid back Phoenix on the nice terms that they gave us, and just kind of steamrolled. And
so, and just to summarize quickly though, Kevin, because yeah. I think there's an important lesson there that often goes missed, and yeah. I resonate with it. You know, I started in a basement or a garage, you know, yeah. a little different, but taking that first step to be like, we're going to do it with what we've got, right? Having finding the smallest space you possibly, because I've seen your equipment warehouses now, and it makes me chuckle to think that that was once a garage. And then I assume when that hurricane occurred again in the insurance business, catastrophes come and are often, you know, things that a lot of the companies in this space want to work on, because it produces a large volume of work. So did you just pack up with those favorable terms and literally head down there to find work?
So dude, it was actually kind of a little bit crazy, thinking about it hindsight now. So I was working in my mom's garage, and through doing these classes, I was a huge believer in Phoenix restoration equipment. And so at the time, Phoenix wasn't really a recognized brand in Canada back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And we were bringing them into the mix with showcasing their product in our schools that I was telling you about. And so when I wanted to get into this bigger type work, you know, I was chatting with them to see if we could procure some equipment and arrange a deal. And honestly, they're I had these angel moments, and maybe we'll get into a couple of them in this conversation. Yeah. But Phoenix, they basically gave me an unbelievable term. So they gave me a semi worth of equipment. I had no money. I had no credit. I was a nobody, frankly. And they effectively gave me 90 days of, here's the equipment, don't pay for 90 days. And then pay off the equipment in the subsequent 90 days, a third, a third, a third. So I basically had 6 months terms with them, and they were financing it for that time. And so we rolled the dice and took the equipment. I had no work. I had no idea how I was going to get the jobs. I had no
nothing. What was the value of that, by the way? Just for like, so you're starting off and they've just given you these favorable terms, but at the end of the day, like, it's debt over a period of time.
It is
debt. What kind of risk was that?
It was probably in and around $500,000 US.
Oh, so it's that's not like a $10,000 loan.
Yeah, no. They bet on me and risked on me, and I had no idea how the hell we were going to pay for it, frankly.
But sometimes that's a good fire to have, right? They're like, oh,
yeah,
shit, that worked. Now we got to go do this.
Well, so serendipitous, if you want to call that. So we procured that equipment, and then around a month-ish or so after the fact, that first hurricane hit.
Right.
And so we literally shipped that gear down there, and we did I still have pictures on my phone. I can show you later, but we did a couple hotels and apartment buildings, and we paid for all that equipment during those few months we were down in Florida.
That's so happens when, so two young entrepreneurs have taken a punt. How old businesses do? I mean, even my NBC group, I didn't have a business plan. I just was like, I could do this.
Yeah.
And then you just go give it a go, don't you? And then it sort of evolves into something bigger than you.
Yeah.
So where you've tested this theory, you've chased a catastrophe. So now what? Because again, it's not as if those
right. Well, we came back from a few months of down there, and we were kind of obviously quite proud of ourselves because we did something. Right. We accomplished something. We paid off the debt, thank God. Yeah. And we didn't burn that bridge, which was great. And then we came back to reality of being back in Canada and figure out how we're going to legitimize and create a business. And right. So what ended up happening is in late 04, 05, we created DryTech. At the time, the company was called DryTech. And we decided to stick to the theme of supporting restoration contractors exclusively. And so in our local market in Ottawa, we started soliciting ourselves to local and surrounding local, like Cornwall, kind of like within a couple hour radius of Ottawa, subcontract mitigation and abatement services. So we would do residential tear out, cleanup and whatnot as a sub to other restoration companies.
Which is interesting because that's sort of a niche, that's right.
Yeah, it's a micro niche because, to be honest, back 20 years ago, it didn't exist. There was one other company locally in Ottawa that was doing some of that. Actually, still, we're actually buddies with him now. We're still competitors, but friendly competitors. But there was no real other supplier that existed like this really anywhere.
Right.
And so it was a bit of an interesting business model. And I've stuck with that until this very day. Now that's changing, and perhaps we'll chat a little bit about that, but the market shifting and whatnot. But we stuck with that theme, and over the course of, from 04, 05 up until 2015, I ran that company, and we scaled from my mom's garage to being arguably top two, top three equipment rental company in North America. We were handling marquee projects all over the US and Canada, and chasing every major disaster that you'd ever see on, broadcast news and whatnot. And we kind of built a brand as being one of the go-tos to support restoration companies.
But you know what it is, though? I just love hearing that story because my favorite saying, and I say it all the time, is luck is opportunity meets preparedness, right? Yep. And so taking that jump and then focusing on, because restorers are very good at drawing boundary lines and combative lines with competitors. Yep. And so I guess flying under that allowed you, give you access to like an international group that didn't see you as a competitor anymore, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I'm kind of reliving this whole scenario again because I ended up having a falling out with my partners in 2015, and that battle ensued late 15 into early 2016, and ultimately led to me getting forced out of that company. And there's a Hollywood blockbuster story within that whole experience of 6 or so months.
Trust me, I feel as though that when I have you on the second time on this podcast, I'm gonna rewatch this, and we're going to spend the whole session talking about that blockbuster movie, because I have one of my own to share. I just don't think it, I don't think we can give it the attention it deserves on today's show, but I'm parking that for episode two.
There's a lot to unpack in that one, believe me. There's some pretty wild stuff. But
so you had a parting of ways with business partners after this business scaled. And then where does Kevin find himself?
I went to, so I didn't have two nickels to rub together when this all happened. So I didn't have the financial wherewithal to start another company. So I went to go work for a friendly competitor in the US, and I was going to build their North American operation. So they had a lot of large industrial drying equipment, climate control equipment, similar to what I had at my previous company. And they mostly focused in the non-restoration categories. So industrial coating, so like shipyards where they're doing climate control for like military and things like that, pharma, new construction, things like that, where restoration is a very small component of their business. And at that point, I had a pretty vast network, and they seen the value in me coming on board and really scaling that up. And it was a great opportunity for everybody. So I joined their company, and 2 weeks later, they got acquired.
I hear that. So who acquired them?
It was a Greco.
Right.
So okay. one of the largest power companies in the planet. And so they, you know, didn't need my services at that point, because, you know, it is what it is. And subsequently, the owner of the company that I was about to work with basically said, well, you know what? You got a raw deal on what happened at your last company. We feel bad, and we want to see success, be successful. And that was my second angel moment, where the owner wired my wife $150,000 US on a handshake, sent me two semis of equipment, and said, go start your company again.
This gentleman that hired you to help him help build his. Well, I love hearing that as well, because it goes back to, you know, business owners often aren't cash rich. A lot of their worth and equity is tied up in the business, which is, as you know, not as accessible often as you'd like. And so he obviously benefited from an exit, a sale ultimately, which is kind of, I guess, eventually an entrepreneur's goal or dream at some point. But do you think that, I love that though, because then that kickstarted you, and you think you'd, In a weird way, I think you'd return that favor down the line, right? If you could.
Oh, absolutely. I definitely plan to. I actually did a little mini one of those recently with a hairstylist friend of mine. But I hope to do a couple more of those. But yeah, I literally had nothing. My wife at the time was a single mom. I just had my third kid. I had no money, but my company was my investment vehicle, and I was all in on that. So I had no savings. Like, I was screwed. And so this guy, like, I don't know what possessed him to do that, but I wouldn't be sitting here right now if it wasn't for him. So that was Joe Schroeder. And he gave me that opportunity. And so I took it and ran. And at the time, my previous company was still operating. And so when we launched, we put my previous company out of business in 8 weeks.
So is this your new company is Restoration Co.
Currently, now. Yeah, the same one.
Yeah. Well, again, I draw lots of resonance with that, because my longtime nemesis disappeared, and it took me longer than a few weeks to do it, but I did it. So how did that, you opened up shop in Ottawa then?
So we opened up shop in Ottawa. I started working with another individual, subcontractor, and there's a story to go there. It's kind of bitter and unfortunate that it ended the way it did, but it is what it is. And as things kind of go. So it's been since February 2016 till today, we've been running that company, and we've arguably scaled up to be, again, one of the largest equipment rental companies within the space. Mind you, we haven't made the same investments, and we've kind of backed off on the strategy a little bit, because the market's changing, you know.
Tell me a little bit about that, because I've got a good segue to go from here, but I want to know a little bit about what your take on the market changes are, because I've started to see that as well within the insurance sector. And so I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
There's a lot to unpack within that. In simple terms, the market's becoming more commoditized. There's a lot of new players coming into the mix, cost consultants being one, third-party adjusting firm, TPAs, legacy, or how do I call them? I typically call them legacy, legacy rental companies. So like the large commodity rental houses like a Sunbelt or a United or a Herc, these massive conglomerates that are entering the restoration space, and that puts all kinds of pricing dynamics into the mix. And then you have all these other independents that, you know, what I seen 20 years ago are now entering the mix. So there's an abundance of supply from my angle, right. We do coming in, which then with there's an abundance of supply, and that usually drives down price.
Yeah. And so what does that look, how do you, given that your business is based on rental of equipment and obviously expertise, what does that look like for that company? You know, I often look at, from our perspective as a service firm, appraising, forensics, or even adjusters, with the introduction of new technologies and artificial intelligence and tools, what you have to plan the landscape of the business, because you won't need there won't be as many people doing those jobs in the next 5 to 10 years. And so taking a longer look at how you can, I guess, risk manage your organization to succeed through that, right?
Yeah, I was kind of, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was, given the nature of my business model and how we provided the service that I've been sharing with you, we delivered the service effectively at a deep discount to the contractors we were working with. But frankly, we had the same overhead infrastructure. We paid our people competitively. We still had the same vehicle, insurance, gas, et cetera, et cetera. And when I looked at all this, I'm like, okay, well, how do we have similar costs to our customers, but deliver the product and the service at a much discounted price and still be a viable solution? And so it forced me to become, the answer was technology. So it forced me to become a tech-minded operator. So I didn't realize the benefits of it until the last few years. But I started investing a lot into technology, frankly, 15 years ago, plus when, you know, cloud computing was basically in its infancy. Salesforce was like just coming out effectively, things like that, right? And I started investing a lot into tech, understanding how to apply tech to the space. It really changed my thinking on, you know, markets in general and business models in general and all that good stuff. And when I started this company that I currently run, and understanding some of the things I've shared with you already, I had part of my long-term strategy, which is just in the starting of coming to fruition now, was that I was going to democratize the equipment rental business.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're right at this point right now, and the strategy is just about to come to light. It's been 10 plus years in the making.
So is this hot off the press then? Is this like first public announcement of this?
It's fairly public now. Sorry. This is hot off the press. Yes. I'm not going to give the full strategy. It's not quite there, but it's just about there.
So are you bringing the Uber Airbnb model to the restoration industry?
Perhaps.
I love it. My thought process is along the same way for everything, which is how EcoClaim came about. But yep. That's exciting. I'm looking forward to seeing how you've developed a model to disrupt that.
Yeah, so it's in full force now. We just secured a bunch of venture capital on the Kahi side, which we haven't even really talked about. That's my other company. And then the government actually is pretty interested from a grant perspective. We were just named the fifth fastest growing company in Ottawa. And if you look at national benchmarks, we're like top 30 in Canada for growth. Last 3 years, we've grown almost 600%. So like we're moving at a pretty, pretty fast clip right now.
Nice.
And so with the fresh capital, we're tripling up R&D and sales and marketing. And over the next 12 months, there's going to be some really interesting stuff coming out of Kahi and DrySource.
Fill me in on, my journey was similar to yours, traditional service firm. I say traditional servicing, a niche. And then was just, I say wrapped up, but you can't help but absorb all the news about technology and SaaS and combine it for us with ESG. That's where I saw the opportunity to create a business that could be much larger and scalable without requiring the same kinds of concentrate. Is like for MBC to grow, you need more technical people to deliver more services, which ultimately there's like a, it's not as easy to find that organically.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so for me, I saw software as a way to solve a problem for customers, but also scale a business to be larger without relying on hundreds of people.
Yeah, it's actually easier to create an exponential organization than it is a linear organization.
Right.
For people to wrap their minds around that's difficult, but it's true.
So how did you make the jump? What was the, you're selling restoration services to restorers and support. And then how do you suddenly a sensor company's born? What was the angel moment?
On the technology side of the business, Yeah. So
like to separate it out.
Yeah. So I dabbled in this once before my previous company. So it started back then, frankly. I built a team and a software that we were just about to launch, and then it came to light based on the story I shared with you. But the premise of that was that we automated all our field service data collection at the last company. So time, materials, equipment, moisture readings, all that. And basically we're leveraging our technicians to be our admins and operational data collectors. So my idea was always to reduce costs is, we collect a piece of data, it should be one and done, not go from the technician to a PM to an admin to a billing clerk, so on and so forth. And just it's increasing costs for no reason. So we had built a system called Navaha back then, which is an ancient Sanskrit word for the word flow.
Okay.
And so that was my first foray into tech. And then with our current company, I always had a hankering and a strong desire to build technology. I was fascinated by it. I love the idea of exponential growth and serving many and being creative and whatnot. And so with this current company, we had a problem of tracking our fleet. We have a ton of equipment, as do other restoration companies, in terms of having challenges in tracking it. And we kind of seen that as an opportunity, one, to solve a problem for ourselves, but two, also turn it into a product that we could ultimately sell as an MVP, like, initial product that we can penetrate the market with and get some sales traction and whatnot. And so that we started with asset tracking and just tracking equipment. And it's the strategies evolved now, and really we're an automated field data collection system now. Asset tracking is just a component of what we do. We want to build a whole host of analytics around the equipment and how the equipment behaves. When you look at the property restoration industry, specifically mitigation, when you're talking equipment, it's billions and billions of dollars, like multiple tens of billions, just equipment revenue or cost, depending on what side of the coin you're looking at, for insurance companies or contractors. And so all parties have a significant interest in how that equipment gets deployed and how it gets billed in the claims process. And so, of that, there's a whole host of problems that need to be solved in order to provide predictability, both for the carriers and the service providers, provide transparency for the same parties, and then ultimately deliver best outcomes and define what a best outcome is. Yeah. And so,
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, within that lies our strategy and our thesis. So those three kind of components are what we're striving to do in the property restoration space. And I think if we can solve that, we'll have a pretty big winning recipe.
I think this is all coming together at the right time because on the backdrop of sustainability, and you know, eco claims near and dear to me for that. And one of the areas of focus for eco claim is very much dry in place. Yeah. And now that it's teaching dry in place is not new. I mean, there's I would say it's well understood, but it's misunderstood, but technically well documented and scientifically documented.
It's actually not in restoration. It's well documented in other industry, but not in property restoration.
I wasn't referring to restoration as a surveyor. From my perspective, it's a scientific process.
Right.
Right. That follows calculations, and that's how it should always be, like, right.
But what's wild is there's literally hundreds of billions of dollars of work being done in water damage specifically. And the vast majority, like high 90%, is not using any of that science. They think they are, but they're not.
Bingo. So that's where I was going with that. So from whether it's a cost consulting standpoint, which is why you see a prevalence of them because of that mm-hmm. dollar figure, or yeah. from a sustainability standpoint of eco claims, mm-hmm. the problem you're solving is if we can dry a building rather than demo and reinstate, that mm-hmm. not only saves cost for the insurer because it's more economical to do so, if it reinstates the property, and more importantly, has a much lower greenhouse gas footprint than yep. the resulting construction would. Now, why that's not more commonly used as a fewfold? Lack of understanding and education on what it is and how to apply it from both the insurer and restorer side.
Yep.
The big issue has been the evidence of doing it. Exactly. So because if it's not done correctly, it poses a future risk to the insurer that they will have to pay anyway.
Exactly.
And as you said before, documenting it. I mean, how many times have we seen a drying meter on a piece of drywall, which could be anywhere in the world? That doesn't prove it was there anyway. And so the problem you're solving is the ability to document that accurately live at site, so that all parties and stakeholders can see what's going on and the result of it, which is A, transparency, but B, we dry in place more rather than demo rebuild.
Yeah, and taking it even a step further. So when you look at immutable data as well, data that can't be manipulated by a technician or a manager or whatever above that technician once they receive the data on their scribbly paper or change the numbers in their app, you know, things like that. But even beyond that, you start to look at, you know, things that we've done where you can go down to the level of detail to the make and model of a piece of equipment that was deployed to a job. We can now know exactly how that piece of equipment should be behaving within that chamber.
Right.
Based on environmental conditions outside, like physically outdoors, as well as what's the conditions in the building, and then factoring in other things like the class of loss, is the HVAC system running, and so on and so forth. And so it becomes a matter of fact, whereas right now there's a lot of opinions floating around and a lot of bad opinions at that. And so,
and it shouldn't be a matter, it's not an opinion. That's the point.
It's not.
Agreed.
As we move forward here, literally in the next couple of months, we'll start pushing this technology into the market, advocating this message, and really starting to, I like to call it bridge building, where we can bring all stakeholders together. So, you know, the consultants, the carriers, the service providers, and frankly, even the people that own the buildings, where we can create these bridges where we can share data amongst one another that's trusted, provides transparency. It's a matter of fact. It's not opinion-based. And it'll hopefully expedite claims. It'll impact the ESG initiatives in a positive way. It'll reduce claim costs. Frankly, what's interesting, the restoration contractors will actually make more profit, which is important. So that aligns them from that perspective, because they're obviously incentivized by making profit. So I think it's a winning recipe all around, and the people that own the buildings get their building back quicker. So it's to me, it just makes sense in many ways.
But it should in theory make the project manager's life easier, because his data collection and support for the work he's doing on the drying side, if it's automatically collected and shared among stakeholders that allow them to get paid quicker, The biggest issue I see is that, take it out. I'm not going to call it an issue because, again, I face the same challenge with EcoClaim, is that you've developed something that makes a lot of sense and is required and will solve a problem. Yeah. However, as you know, getting any industry to change for the better, especially construction and especially on the insurance side of that, that's the challenge.
Yeah, they're slow moving.
Right.
But I think we're at that point of the hockey stick where it starts to curve up. And I think we're, you know, in the next, I don't know, few years anyways, we'll be looking back and be like, holy crow, this moved quite quickly.
Yes.
So, but traditionally, yes, it moves slow. The cost of deploying IoT technology and other technologies, and that's the thing actually, is we're just at this point now where these different exponential technologies are starting to converge, and it's in the convergence where these new business models and these new opportunities come, and we're just starting to get that capability now.
Yeah.
And I used to say, I was a little bit early in my estimations, but I always used to say that 5G was the benchmark. 5G connectivity.
Yep.
And that was the measuring stick that I used for many, many years. That would be the tipping point where we would start to see this convergence of multiple technologies coming together. And I think it's a little bit slow because 5G has now been out for what, a couple of years maybe. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, we're right there, and the way AI is moving now, it's kind of nutty, but
agreed. You know, that again, EcoClaim's business model, just like yours, is a convergence of technologies. Like we would collaborate with yourselves, collect that data that you're collecting to filter it through our sustainability lens to produce the required reporting on that side. And so again, we're not in the market to create a drying system that tracks a loss, because that is already a market. So how do you converge those technologies to collect data for multiple different reasons, not just on the dry?
Yeah. And that's something too, that's, I think, where we'll be able to help, is that we kind of knew that. We wanted to be like very focused on automating field data collection. And we knew that we couldn't be vanilla ice cream to everybody. So we weren't going to be able to do everything, at least do everything well. So we focused on the few things that I think we do exceptionally well. And we built the platform in such a way where we're API first.
Yeah.
So meaning that our data is, the way we collect our data is also very accessible to integration partners, perhaps such as yourselves or
others
that would have a material interest in it. And being able to connect and share that data so then we can continue to drive these other processes and outcomes.
Absolutely.
So that's a key point.
And that's what you can show with data is outcomes to clients, which is what they want ultimately.
Yeah.
So one thing I wanted to touch on, and again, I know we could talk forever, but as we start to run up to the end, tell me about the big flood, because hot topic, we're on the subject of drying a building. And you recently, on purpose, flooded your own building.
Right.
And I want to hear, A, how you decided to do that, how it went, and when's the next one?
That's funny. So in our training side of our business, we were teaching a class in Vancouver last October. And one of the students said to me, he's like, you know, it's really cool that you like allow us to play with the machines and whatnot, because no other classes do that. But if you really want to make it like extra cool, you should just flood the place. I'm like, it took me about like 5 seconds. I'm like, you know what? We're going to do it.
That's awesome. I love that.
Yeah, we'll do it. And then my partner dared me, because I was like, after I committed, I'm like, I don't know if I should do this, because we don't own a building, we rent.
Right. Yeah, so like, I take that back. You flooded your TIs.
And we so anyway, I went down this process of trying to convince the ISRC, and it took a bit of effort, but we finally pushed it through. And then by the time I got approval, I had 8 weeks to do it. And before I even had approval, I already committed to doing it on social media.
I know that's the best way to do it half the time.
There was some strategy involved in there, we'll say. And then, so anyways, I got approval. I had 8 weeks to put this thing on. So, long story short, we dumped 12,000 gallons of water into my Toronto office. I didn't quite have approval to do it, but I did it anyways. I was confident in our ability. So that means something, I think.
Yeah. Well, they can't prove it was wet now. So what's the problem?
Well, it happened. My landlord ended up actually being quite cool about it after the fact. So it was all right. But in my nature and how I, operate, it went from doing a technical training program where we flood my building and teach people how to drive the building to, how do we really like make this something different that's special that can really kind of level up and maybe perhaps start a movement? And so all of that kind of transpired into bringing together a roster of 13 or 14 different individuals, two of which were part of your team, and they did an exceptional job. But we brought in different subject matter experts on T&M building, the engineering and appraisal side, sales and marketing, the technical components with some of the E3 algorithms, some of the stuff we're doing, and so on and so forth. And so we had
it into a conference, essentially a mini conference, right?
It was an event. Yeah, had the whole thing lasted 6 days. We did 2 days pre ISRC commercial drawing specialist class. So the first front loaded 2 days, we flooded the building on the Sunday. And then Monday and Tuesday, we ran the class from 7:30 in the morning till 10 p.m. at night. We put a 4,500 square foot tent in my parking lot that we climate controlled. And we spent an insane amount of money on AV. And we had, between students, sponsors, and support staff, we had 170 people in the tent. And we broadcasted the mitigation effort that my team predominantly handled in the building. We broadcast it through our cameras to the tent on the big screen, and the students got to participate a little bit, and we just provided an immense amount of training and
was that first of its kind,
first ever.
Yeah, because it seemed, again, that's what I like about these things, they seem like obvious things to do once they're done, because I'm like, why would you not flood a building and prove you could dry it? Like, in general, they do fires to see how things burn, right? And but I only heard good things from our team, and I know Christensen, our VP of the insurance services, is the only person ever to wear a tie to a contractor event. So I'm sure you'll be remembered for that.
Yeah, you know what? Him and Matt both did a fantastic job. I gotta just take a moment just to give credit to you and your team, because they walked into the lion's den.
Yeah,
because what your team does in that, at least in that sphere of your business, often is contentious and can be adversarial. I think your guys handled it with grace. They were empathetic. They were knowledgeable. They were willing to take some difficult questions and just did a really great job. And I think at the end, everyone was like, you know what? I would actually like to work with those guys.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what it's about. You know, you've known me for like 10 years now, and I tried, you know, every project's different and you don't influence everyone, but you know, I try to instill in our team that we're there to help facilitate, get it done, not put up barriers and roadblocks and cut invoices. It's about working together to document it, support it, so that everyone ultimately gets paid and the building gets restored as quick as possible. And I think that often gets lost sometimes because there's egos involved. And
you guys have likely failed, I'm sure have failed many claims where you perhaps will say been in the wrong for whatever that means wrong, as have many contractors, myself included. And so, like, you know, all we can do is get better. What it did though is it started a conversation, and I think that was pretty cool. And it was neat. And so to your question, we're going to be doing another one in November. So we're going to reflood the building again in November in Toronto. We'll do it there again, and then eventually we'll perhaps do a roadshow. A few people have offered up their buildings now.
Oh really?
Now that is
cool. You get it. I feel like there's a business in itself there somehow. You went from dryer to now just flutter.
Yeah, exactly. And that it was an obscene amount of effort. I kind of run parallels to going down to a disaster zone, because we had to put this thing on in 8 weeks and organize all these vendors and food. Like, the food was top shelf. Like, I wanted to create an experience that if I was actually the attendee, what's the standard that I would want in terms of everything down to the fine details. And because of that, I put a lot of pressure on myself and the team to deliver a high quality thing. I think we succeeded.
There from across North America.
Yeah,
right?
we actually could have sold the whole thing out to Americans. I actually had to cut the registration off for the US because they were quick to jump on it. And
right.
I ran the risk of holding at the time we had 100% Americans registered. I had to cut them off in order to allow some Canadians to get into the room. So at the end of the day, it worked out perfectly. We had in the zone of 50-50 Canadians to Americans in terms of attendees. There were 115 actual students. The rest were vendors and support staff. And it was pretty cool. But yeah, from California to Florida and everywhere in between, from the west coast of Canada to the east coast of Canada. So there was a really great mix. Yeah,
well, cool. I'll definitely be attending the next one. And
sweet.
If you do that roadshow, I'm all about going somewhere warm where you can golf as well as dry buildings. So
yeah.
I will be a special guest there as well.
We'll chat offline. I got some ideas around that too.
Perfect. And well, until we have you again to discuss our blockbuster stories, that was episode 3 of Lessons of a CEO. Until next time. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy.